I'm Mike Lupig of the New York Daily News and SportsOnEarth.com.
I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
And I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press, and we are the Sports Reporters. We welcome you to another edition of our podcast, which you can hear every Monday and Friday. Later on, we'll get to football and Ezekiel Elliott and a lot of big games coming up, and whether Michael Jordan's proclamation that the super teams are leaving the NBA with 28 garbage teams is actually accurate. But there is no way to not talk about baseball, and this is what we love about October baseball. The game between the Chicago Cubs and the Washington Nationals that already had the makings of a big game going in, but an inning to be remembered or forgotten, depending on where you stand on this thing with Max Scherzer on the mound, turned into one of the wildest playoff games that I can remember, and ultimately results in a week where the Cleveland Indians again disappear, you know, heartbreakingly for their fans. The Chicago Cubs, who managed to do something remarkable last October in winning the World Series in seven games, advance on. What do we think of that game?
Well, first of all, here's what I was reminded of, as if I needed reminding or anybody needed reminding last night and into Friday morning. The Chicago Cubs are a tough out. I think right now they are playing the worst of the four teams still playing in baseball. I think if I was seating everybody right now, they would be seated fourth. But man, oh man, are they a tough out. And again, it's we have seen in the same week in baseball, in what has, we're not even nearly into October yet, and we've had a magnificent postseason. A 1-0 game between the Yankees and the Indians that reminded us again that a 1-0 game in baseball can be everything. And then we got this big, crazy, wonderful, controversial mess last night in which, you know, maybe the biggest play of the game is a challenge on a pickoff play, which we can get into, because I think if you come off the base for a nanosecond, I'm not sure you should be tagged out. But who would have thought in the week of starting pitchers coming out of the bullpen that Max Scherzer would get roughed up the way he did last night?
No, that was the part of the whole spectacle of it. Absolutely, it's just like, for example, in the Red Sox and Astros, at one point in Game Five, the winning pitcher of record was Sale, and the losing pitcher of record was Verlander. And 17 seconds later, they flipped. And the winning pitcher right. turned out to be Verlander, and the losing pitcher turned out to be Sale. But as far as Scherzer in that whole inning goes, it starts off with an infield single and a hustling catcher beating out an infield single. And we all know what it went through. I won't go through the recitation, but in the middle of it all, I was watching and tweeted, "All we need now is the only thing left is the plague of locusts." I mean, what else? Yeah, I saw this. There are seven ways to reach first base, and they reached first base in five of them in that inning.
Right, intentional walk, drop, third strike,
including the dreaded catcher's interference.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I mean, this also raises a question to me, though. This is a pet peeve of mine. This business of turning starters into relievers in the offseason, in the postseason. I don't know that it's the smartest thing to do. First of all, you end up doing it a lot of times with guys on short rest, so you're already messing them up. Scherzer had pitched 6-plus innings, what, 3 days earlier? So he had 2 days of rest. He never works on 2 days rest. And then you throw him in the middle of the game, and then everybody acts shocked when things don't work out the way that they thought. Now, granted, he got the first two guys he faced, and he looked like he was all world, and it was like 8 pitches. But he didn't get the rest of them, and then it starts to panic. And, you know, pitchers are – guys like him, they're thoroughbreds. You know, they're used – they're divas on the mound. They're used to a certain rhythm and rotation, and all of a sudden it's like, well, you got to do it for your team. You got to get out there and do it for your team, so you got to become a reliever. I've often seen this go bad, and this was
but
like Mitch, historically
Mitch,
bad.
Mitch, it is – with all due respect, even though hardly anything ever good comes after that, I completely disagree with this, because I have seen some of the greatest moments in the history of October that have involved the same thing. I was in Seattle in 1995, where I saw Randy Johnson start one night and close the next and beat the New York Yankees in one of the most memorable division series ever played. I saw Randy Johnson finished the 2001 World Series after he had started the game six the night before. And Mitch, one of the greatest endings I have ever seen in the World Series was Madison Bumgarner coming out of the bullpen in a game seven against the Kansas City Royals. And you kept saying, well, he can't pitch another inning. And then he'd come out for another inning. And finally, he's out there in the bottom of the ninth. I think it is part of the great drama, and boo frickety who if it throws them off their throw schedule, because to see Sale and Verlander, and I wondered about Verlander the other day, to see these two guys, two of the true aces of the sports, going at each other in the middle of the innings of a game they didn't start is just part of the pageant of October to me.
It's part of the pageant. It's fine. I'm just saying you can't always expect the results that you look forward to when they start.
You can't
a game.
Expect it, but Mike's right. I'm siding with Mike on this because I was present for some of these games too. And Mike, do you know who the losing pitcher was in Game 5 in 1995 in the Kingdom?
David Cohn.
No. Jack McDowell.
Jack McDowell, excuse me. Yes.
I'll tell you a little quick story. I'm in the auxiliary press box down the third base line, and of course, Randy's already entered the game, and now I see activity in the Yankee bullpen, and I had little binoculars, and I put them on. I went, holy bleep, it's Jack McDowell. I mean, you know, that was such a thing. Absolutely. Mitch, it comes under the heading. I remember a brief conversation in the hallway in that series with Lou Piniella, and said, let me get something straight. This is before game five. This is after game four. I said, in this circumstances like this, in these games, you just worry about, you do everything you can to win today, and you'll worry about tomorrow when you wake up in the morning, right? And he said, yes.
Yeah. Listen, don't get me wrong. I think pitchers should be able to pitch whenever they're called upon. And I also think pitchers can stay in a little longer than they are in today's game. I'm just saying you can't be surprised when they've been, Mike, I salute your memory that you can pull up the guys when it happens. I wish my memory was as good that I could pull up the guys when it doesn't
but
happen.
I'll give you one more.
Wait,
Burl Hershiser, 88.
Okay. Yes, no, Mitch, here's the thing. And in this postseason, it has worked more often than it hasn't worked. It worked for the Astros the other day with Verlander. It worked for the Red Sox. The only problem with Chris Sale was that Farrell let him stay out there one inning too many. And the only time it went up in smoke was it went up in smoke gloriously last night. But most of the time that I've seen these in big moments in my baseball-loving life, it's been terrific.
Well, on a larger scale, I wonder if this isn't – I wonder if what we saw Thursday night wasn't reflective of what the Cubs did last year. Because I keep thinking back to the Yankees and Cleveland. And what was Cleveland's, you know, overall theme when you looked at last year? Just short. Right? Just came up short. And what was the Cubs' overall theme last year? We got it done. No matter how we had to do, you know, we stretched it, we did it, we got it done. Now you come into this season, we had this discussion a couple weeks ago when they were rounding into playoff form. And I said, you know, that championship memory kicks in when you need it. And the Cubs, like you said, tough. I mean, look at that. All they did was throw walks. I mean, how many guys did they walk? And they were 1-for-11 with guys in scoring position. It looked like Madden was going to pull somebody out of the stands to pitch for him next. But they still end up winning the game. Why? Because there seems to be something in like championship mentality after you've done it. Like, we're fated to do this. It's the feeling you have when you watch the Patriots. It's the feeling you have when you watch the Packers in final seconds against teams that haven't gotten it done. And I think we saw a repeat of that. And the Cubs sort of feel like they're destined to win these things.
And guess what? All the stuff that happened last night, and it was a novel, and it's the kind of novel that you get at this time of year, okay? None of it matters to the Cubs, and they don't have a game this weekend if Wade Davis doesn't come out and throw, 43 pitches and somehow have, going on fumes at the end, have enough to strike out finally Bryce Harper at the end of the game. I'm telling you, it's moments like that, and Aroldis Chapman getting five outs for the Yankees the other night against the Indians, and David Robertson coming out of the bullpen and being the MVP for the Yankees again and again. And, you know, I wrote about this yesterday, by the way, as we turn the page to the Yankees-Astros. The Houston Astros, Bobby, have a chance to do something nobody has ever done in a baseball October, and that is beat both the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox in the same month. The three other teams have had the chance. None of them have been able to finish the job. So they're going icon to icon. And guess what? Guess what? Even if they beat the Yankees, you know who might be waiting for them? The Los Angeles Dodgers, another one of the most iconic teams. And so the drama abounds. And the thing I love about the Astros and the Yankees, by the way, I think they are the two most fun teams playing right now. They are the two most entertaining teams playing. And if Aaron Judge would stop striking out, he would even get more entertaining.
Can you explain him to me, by the way, you know, as someone who doesn't live in New York, yeah. And but you know, you see his name every second because he plays for the Yankees. I don't recall a guy who can be so game-changing or so flamed out in the same season. I mean, you know, he had the wild card game. You thought, okay, well, this guy's not intimidated by the postseason. He's gonna be a legend. And then you had the ALDS series, and what was he, 1-for-20 or something like that? So what's the deal with him? Is it just youth?
I think it's a couple of things. I think one, he's tired. I mean, you know, he's never had this many swings in his life. Okay. And I think that they have figured it out, and you hear a lot of hoo-ha, and it's the old changing the eye angle and, you know, inning and outing him. But the big thing with him is they've got him off balance right now. And Mitch, again, here's another fascinating part of the whole baseball experience at this time of year. He may have made the single biggest play that anybody has made for any team so far when he reached over the right field wall when they were facing elimination on Sunday night and pulled back a home run that Frankie Lindor tried to hit. It would have made the game 2-0 for the Indians. They would have eliminated the Yankees that night. So he's being forgiven right now despite this epic strikeout pace because he probably saved their asses in the middle of the game last Sunday night.
Well, It is historic. Remember, the man led the league in home runs, strikeouts, and walks, and that is who he is. But he has taken it to an epic proportion with 16 strikeouts in the ALDS.
Hey, Mitch, there's a great stat going on right now about Aaron Judge. Okay, this came from Zach Lupica, my youngest. Aaron Judge in the 2017 ALDS, 23 plate appearances, 16 strikeouts. Tony Gwynn of the Padres, 1995 regular season, 577 plate appearances, 15 strikeouts.
Wow. Well, they're going to have their hands full in Houston. I mean, I think Houston is a complete team. You know, Altuve is off the charts. And, you know, historically, Dallas Keuchel is really, really good against the Yankees. Now, you know, I don't even like saying that sentence because, like, the minute it leaves your lips, it's like, so therefore he'll lose in this series because nothing is as it seems when you get into these dramatic postseasons. But with Justin Verlander in game two, you know, if Keuchel is good against the Yankees as he normally is, and then you come back with Verlander, I mean, they're strong. I still favor Houston to get to the World Series, but I don't. Bets are off now that the Yankees have done what they've done, and I imagine Mike and Bob that since you're on the East Coast, Joe Girardi's job is safe for now. You know, all we heard about it. You know,
Mitch, this is. I saw a headline today. This is one of the great headlines in light of what happened last weekend. How much of an edge will Girardi give Yankees against Astros? And I'm saying, wait a minute. Now that we've pulled him back from out underneath the bus, now this genius is going to give the Yankees the edge. It's unbelievable how fickle things are at this time of year.
Well, I'll tell you, that Astros lineup, because I just got through watching them 8 games in a row, and when you lead off, your leadoff man has 34 homers, and your 9 man has 18 homers, and I'll tell you, the secret weapon there on that team is a guy that the general public just doesn't pay any attention to, and that's Marwin Gonzalez.
First baseman's not bad either, Bobby.
No, Yuli Gurriel, the 33-year-old Cuban rookie. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. No, they're top to bottom. It's a treacherous lineup, but the Yankees have a very good lineup too. And the pitchers are going to have to earn it and against both of these teams. And but Houston is very, very deep and very good. And it's hard to imagine that nobody on that team drove in 100 runs. But I seem to every guy who comes up seems to have 20 homers and 80 ribbies.
Hey, Mitch. By the way, I'm thinking that the difference in height between the guys who will be 1-2 in the MVP voting in the American League, 6'7 to 5'6, yeah. Judge to Altuve, might be the greatest gap from two top finishers since Steve Nash beat out Shaq for the MVP 1 year.
There's going to be a great photo op available at second base, right. Hopefully at some moment in this series. I know that.
One last note before, Bobby, you can get us to football. Isn't it interesting that two of the most significant moments so far in the postseason have involved replay? One, the lack of calling for it, and the other, guy who just happened to notice it in wherever those guys sit and sends a message down to his manager, you know, challenge it. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, these things didn't happen in the game of baseball, and twice already they've been significant.
And Mitch, by the way, somebody pointed this out today, and because we talk a lot about how wonderful the baseball map is, how that they've got, you know, the country covered. The four teams remaining come from the four biggest cities in the United States. Houston, New York,
Happy
Chicago,
days for TV
Los Angeles.
Ratings.
Yeah.
I'm sure Whitey Herzog wishes there had been replay in 1985, but we'll explore that some other day. Yes, football is America's obsession, however, and we had a major off-the-field news. We have, of course, recurring off-the-field news every week when it comes time to play the anthem, but we have an ongoing story, and Ezekiel Elliott. I'm hedging my words here because the lawyers haven't finally spoken, but the latest on that deal is that he won't be playing, the suspension is upheld, but is it? And I guess that's the question. But yes, right now, as far as we know, the suspension has been upheld, and he's the six-game suspension. But I have listened to legal analysts say, as Lee Corso would say, not so fast. And we'll see. It's up to the Cowboys and the lawyers to see how.
Well, is there any hope of this going away, or is it just constantly delaying it? Because if you believe that the league has the right to make the six-game suspension and you're going to have to serve it sooner or later, you wonder if this wasn't kind of a stupid move by the Cowboys and Elliott to challenge it when they did, because now that you got the guts of your season here, and he's going to be gone for it. I mean, he's going to be – they play – I'm looking at their schedule here. So they play the Eagles. They play the Redskins. So they're in their division. They play the Chiefs, which is going to be a damn hard game. Obviously, they play the Falcons, which is going to be a damn hard game. I mean, they could be done. They could be mathematically out of the playoffs by the time he comes back.
Well, this was discussed, I think, from the outset. It was discussed in public discussion about which course of action they should take, and what they gambled, and it appears right now. And I still say it ain't. We're going all Yogi on you here. You know, it ain't over till it's over, and I don't think it's over yet until they give in, and we need to see their response now.
You know, I shot an email to Mitch last night, and I believe this. This falls under the umbrella, Bobby, of the house always wins. Okay, you're right. They can delay it. There can be a lot of legal maneuvering. Brady came up with that fun-loving, madcap, zany Judge Berman. But you always had the sense that they were delaying the inevitable. And, you know, what's ironic to me at this time is, you know, considering the charge against Mr. Elliott, his boss and his owner seems a lot more concerned about the national anthem than he does about players with this kind of past playing for the Dallas Cowboys. Our friend Jamel Hill, who has been once again foolishly sent to the penalty box, said the other day, not in a tweet that got her suspended, that maybe Greg Hardy should have taken a knee, and because that might have been the only thing that got him benched when he was still with the Dallas Cowboys.
Let me talk about that for a second, or ask you guys about that for a second before we get to the games. And you know, a lot of the big quarterbacks are playing some pretty big games this weekend. But not to belabor the protest thing, but you can't not talk about it because it does change every week. And you're right, Jamel is now suspended for encouraging fans to boycott the Dallas Cowboys if they want to show their displeasure with Jerry Jones's edict. And it looks like the league is kind of basically saying, all right, enough already, and everybody stand up, which is probably going to result in more people sitting down. But what seems apparent to me from all of these developments is that bottom line is starting to matter here. And we all know this. that the NFL can talk all it wants about social issues and community and involvement and players. It's a money league. And I was not at all surprised that Jamel got suspended, because you're now touching the nerve center of the football business and the broadcasting business, which is money. And you start telling people that advertisers should be boycotted to show protest. You are attacking the money. And let's face it, and I love Jamel, we all love Jamel. And I hate to see her suspended for anything, because she's just showing intelligence and conscience. But she indirectly takes money from the NFL too. She gets paid by the NFL. The NFL gives money to ESPN. ESPN gives money to her. You're in business with these people. You can't be surprised when bottom lines start getting affected. And I think they're starting to see this. I think the TV networks are starting to see it and all the rest of it, that all of a sudden everybody goes rigid and starts saying, okay, enough already with these protests. We need to, and it's so far from what the protest was originally about or what any of them are about, but it is about money. And that's why you're seeing all the things we saw this week.
Well, you touched upon, you know, the overriding philosophical point here, which is that we have gotten so far away from what Colin Kaepernick was trying to say last year, and now we're in an entirely different thing. And once again, it must be pointed out that I don't have the slightest doubt that we would not be discussing this. It would be a peripheral, minor, almost forgotten issue if the POTUS had not injected himself into the conversation in the manner that he did a few weeks back. And now it's all about flag and military, which, of course, it was never intended to be.
See, I never thought it was anything other than about money. The wisdom on this goes back to something the late, great George Young, the Football Giants general manager, said to me about a contact dispute once. Yeah. And I said, the player in question says it's not about the money. And George laughed and he said, Mike, when they say it's not about the money, it's always about the money. Okay. And I wrote the week it started with Colin Kaepernick, and I went on the Sports Reporters and said the same thing, that this was the beginning of the end of his NFL career. I said, I hoped it didn't happen. I wasn't putting any sort of value judgment on it. I was just being a realist. Okay. And now they've all run into this buzzsaw where, and tell me, Bob, yeah, because Bob, you know, Mitch, Bob is one of the great things about Ryan is he is a passionate student of history. Bob, tell me if you think there's anything wrong with the optics of a bunch of rich old white guys telling basically a bunch of young African Americans in this country that, in an ironic way, now they're supposed to genuflect in what their definition of America and patriotism is. Golly, what could ever go wrong with something like that?
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, somebody ought to trot out that famous Frederick Douglass essay, if you will, about patriotism and 4th of July and what the 4th of July means to it was Negro then. It was in the 19th century. This is so absolutely. That's the underlying issue. There's so many.
Mitch, and then I'll just throw this over to you. The selective patriotism of the National Football League is so insanely hypocritical. How many millions of dollars did this league and its partners take from the Department of Defense for these patriotic honoring of servicemen? Well, yeah, because it was a paid spot in stadium after stadium, year after year in this sport.
Yeah, it was. And I think people were shocked kind of to find that out. And every week at the Lions game, that's like the loudest cheer that there is when they bring a veteran out onto the field. Last week, they found a guy from World War II. And I mean, he received a larger standing ovation than the Lions ever do, even when they win. But it's all tied together, guys. And you know, we have to. The players are taking a lot of money to play this game. They are in the entertainment business. Here's how confusing it is. You have read the same things that I have. Have you not now seen that there is a paragraph in something that's called the NFL Operations Manual or something like that, that says players must or should stand for the anthem, hands over their hearts, all the rest of it. And they can't even determine if that is legitimate or not legitimate. If the word should means they have to or they don't. If that's really part of the code or isn't part of the code. I mean, you're literally staring at a paragraph that basically explains what you're supposed to do. And they're disputing whether that paragraph is legitimate or not. So this is how deep the disagreements on this thing have come. But the one thing that is undeniable across the board is that this is a money sport, paid entertainment. The players are getting paid, the networks and the commentators and people like Jamel are getting paid, and they are in business together. ESPN is in business with the NFL.
You keep saying Jamel, but by the logic of that, she would never be able to criticize any sort of political thing in any sport because
no, that's ESPN, not true. That's not true at all. That's not the logic of that. What I'm saying is when you are governed by rules of business, you cannot be surprised when the people who pull those strings, the top businessmen, say you are affecting a bottom line. You can't do that. And what got them spooked about what Jamel said was she was potentially affecting a bottom line, and they're in business together. That's my point. Not political things, because political things are judgment calls. Is that bad enough? Is that not bad? Is that sensitive? Is that insensitive? But when you start saying take money out of the pockets of our partners, you are going to get hammered. That does not surprise me. It's not right. I don't like it. I think the comments Jamel made this time were far more reasoned and right on the point than the more emotional ones she made about the president in terms of, you know, calling him names and things like this was like seemed mild by comparison to the actual wording. But yet you noticed that these were the ones that got her suspended.
But Mitch, the larger point that Jamel was making. Okay, and I spoke to her about this, and I agree with you, and I was joking with her. I said, gee, I thought what you said about the president was way worse than this. Right. The larger point that she was making was, I didn't even think that the boycott was, the financial boycott or whatever the heck it was as important as that Jones was putting his own players in an extremely bad spot, and that the fans shouldn't be mad at them. And he is putting the players in a bad spot. And I would like Mr. Jones to explain to me what the locked arms thing really meant to him now that it says he's going to bench players if they don't stand for the national anthem. Well, Jerry, I got a question for you. I do have a question. How will you stick to that if Dak Prescott and Dez Bryant decide to take a knee before the next Cowboys game? You going to bench them? Really?
And that's where this may all be headed, you know, and it's maybe a showdown. And, you know, what's terrible about it, besides the fact that, you know, it takes apart what's otherwise such an enjoyable experience for people and politicizes it, is that it goes back to what Bob said, is that nobody even knows what this is about anymore. It's become about you can't control me. Well, I can control you. Well, I'm not going to listen to you. Or you're going to listen to me. Well, the president should be telling me what to do. Well, you guys can't tell me what to do. Well, I have my First Amendment rights. Well, no, you don't actually, because you're working for a company. So it's not the same thing. The company's not the government, which is what the First Amendment talks about. It's endless. And I don't want to belabor it here on this show because we'll be talking about it on Monday and the next Friday and all the rest of it. But it has been interesting, and I'll leave it with the point that when money gets involved, and I'm actually staring at on my screen here now as I've been surfing around while we're talking, a CNBC story, you know, the business network, about how Fox had to realign its profits for this quarter because of the poor ratings in the NFL. And when it starts finding its way into these kinds of stories, these are the stories that the guys who own the teams read. And the commissioner reads. And that's why it doesn't surprise me that they're desperately trying to put an end to this. And, of course, by doing that, they may continue it. Anyhow, we can get on to the actual games of this weekend. Really.
Oh, good. And the games, well, I mean, obviously, there are a couple of interesting games. The Packers and the Vikings, for sure. And we saw another example of his greatness from Aaron Rodgers last week, it just reminded us how dangerous he is to the opposing team. The other game, of course, I have a residual interest here in the game in New Jersey because it's a battle for first place, Michael. Battle for first place with the New York Jets and the New England Patriots.
J-E-T-S. Jets. who were supposed to lose all their games so they could draft the Southern California quarterback. Now the real suck fest is the Giants, who haven't won a game and probably aren't going to beat the Broncos on Sunday night and are in a team in complete disarray. Here's why the Patriots and the Jets are interesting to me. Not from the Jets' point of view, okay? Except they can play defense. Brady has a sore left shoulder, and you know that the Jets are going to go after him because that's their only chance to win the game. Bob, if the Patriots struggle against the Jets, even on a road game and even with their quarterback dinged up, to me, this will just be another part of the narrative that they aren't nearly as good as we thought they were coming into the season.
Oh, we've already established that, Mike. I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that we've established that it's farcical to think that people were talking seriously, suggesting they had a chance to go 19-0. They have been exposed in certain ways. First of all, the loss of Edelman was really, really big, and very, very important. Ineffective play of Stephen Gilmore, at whom Bill Belichick threw $65 million to assure up his defensive backfield. He has not delivered the goods. They did not have a pass rush coming in. They have no pass rush. The loss of Rob Ninkovich is more important than people realize. They haven't run the ball very well at all. And if it weren't for Brady's continued brilliance, they would be definitely 1-4, and deserve. This is one time where the Parcells edict that I always despised, that you are what your record says you are, because so most often it's not true. And in this case, they're not a 3-2 team. They have been a 1-4 team.
May I ask Philly guy Mitch Albom a question?
Yes.
Are the Eagles as for real as they look like last night against Cam and them on Thursday Night Football?
I had the advantage of having just seen Carolina in person 4 days or 5 days before, because they came to Detroit to play the Lions. Lions were considered a pretty decent team, and Carolina handled them fairly easily until the last quarter, and Cam looked like all world. And his receivers look like all world. And Dixon, had 175 yards catching. And then they go in and they play against the Eagles, and they look like they're struggling to get to the top of the water to breathe. And that's a nod to the Eagles' defense, which is fantastic. They did exactly what you have to do to Cam Newton: rough him up. I mean, no one ever needs to wonder how you get Cam Newton off his game. You look back to the Super Bowl, where he came in at 15-1, and then he got sacked, it was 6-7 times by the Broncos, and he wasn't the same. And he gets inaccurate when you rattle him, and he's got that arm that he tends to throw a little, he can put a little too much mustard on it periodically. Anyhow, he tends to throw high. You saw how many interceptions he throws. The Eagles took advantage of it. And Carson Wentz, who doesn't have the advertising cachet that Cam Newton does, doesn't have the image that Cam Newton or any of the dances or anything else, but he's a pretty effective quarterback. He knows what he's doing. He finds the open guys. He's got a whip of an arm. And I think the Eagles, forget even, Michael, if I think they're for real, they're sitting so pretty in their division right now. Oh, I mean, they've got the Giants at 0-5, so they don't have to worry about them. They got the Cowboys at 2-3, and Redskins at 2-2. If the Redskins lost their next game, they got a 3-game lead already at this point in the season. So I don't think they have to worry too badly about especially with Ezekiel Elliott out, about winning the NFC East. And after that,
And Mitch, I always say this about an ace pitcher in baseball. You don't even need the stats. You know one when you see one, okay? And I didn't look at Carson Wentz last year, as he played pretty well for a rookie, and I think the Eagles were surprisingly good last year, to say, oh, he's a future immortal. But you know what? I loved his makeup. I loved his arm. I loved the fact that he came out of a school that, most people had never even seen him play in college. And this progression this year has been really, really fun to watch. And guess what? It looks like Jared Goff's going to be good too. So the Rams and the Eagles, I think we're right about both of these kids.
The most amazing factoid that has tumbled out of the entire season thus far is that when you have the Eagles third and long, they got you right where they want you. you're aware of this phenomenon, this incredible the statistics that have come out of how efficient that they have been, that he has been, Carson Wentz, and on third and long. And that's really impressive. I don't ever remember it, that being a focal point of a quarterback discussion about anybody ever, ever. I don't care who we're talking about.
All right, Bob Ryan, I want to ask you a question before we wrap up today's show, and I want to whip this around because it caught my interest, and as a basketball lover, I'm sure it caught yours. So Michael Jordan is quoted, albeit in the magazine Cigar Aficionado, which
my it's like Sports Illustrated for cigar lovers, Mitch.
My subscription ran out, unfortunately, before this issue came to my house, so I had to read it online. But he was asked about the consolidation of talent in the NBA, or what they call super teams. And I'm reading his quote. I think it's going to hurt the overall aspect of the league from a competitive standpoint. You're going to have one or two teams that are going to be great and another 28 teams that are going to be garbage, or they're going to have a tough time surviving in this business environment. Now, as an owner, I think he's talking about one of his teams being the 28 in the garbage. But what do you think of that?
All right, this goes back to a discussion that was last year in the playoffs, and my take is this. All right, maybe I would be proven wrong this year, but in terms of I think this is a bogus media issue, and I think it's a bogus issue. I think that most people understand that only one team can win the championship. You want to have a competitive team, and there are plenty of good, nice teams, and particularly in the West, and there's improving teams in the East. For example, a Milwaukee team that is going to be fun to watch if for only no other reason they got a spectacular, entertaining player in the Greek Freak. All right, here's what I'm saying. I go back to this anecdote. Last year, while I was watching a playoff game by my lonesome, sitting in my easy chair, and the Washington Wizards were running up 26 consecutive points against the Boston Celtics, 26 straight. And the crowd is going out of its mind, the noise sounds as if it's in my living room. And I'm saying to myself, when this game is over, no one is walking out of that building saying, well, you know, that's nice, but we can't beat the Cavs, or, we'd never be able to beat the Warriors. No, they're enjoying the moment. If the game cannot sustain itself because of the nightly joy and pleasure of watching NBA basketball, the best basketball in the world, then it doesn't deserve to exist. It will exist. It'll continue to exist. This idea that the only thing that matters is winning the championship, and everybody is going to base their entire patronage on that, is, I think it's nonsense. Now, maybe I'll be proven wrong.
No, but Bob, look what happens in this sport, okay? And there are teams that are not just screwed for the next 5 years, they're screwed forever. And there's no part of society, including sports, where when the division between rich and poor, and I'm talking about talent rich and poor, is this great, where that to me is a good working model. The Utah Jazz look like they have something good going. They have something really good going. And then the first chance they get, their star player goes and plays for a team that he thinks gives him a better chance to win a championship. When we started the baseball playoffs, I believe, maybe not the Minnesota Twins, but even the Arizona Diamondbacks, I believe everybody in the tournament thought they could win the World Series. When you start the tournament in this sport, it's not going to be anything close to that. And the fact is, Milwaukee's got a nice team. Are they ever going to move all the way up? Stan Van Gundy's making a lot of smart, good moves in Detroit, and he has no chance to compete for a championship anytime soon. I think Michael's got a tough sell for his new marketing slogan, my garbage is better than your garbage, okay? But Bob, I'll be marking time for the playoffs too. I agree with Michael. I don't think it's good for business.
How's this going to manifest itself? And all right, look, if people show up, if they go to the games, if they do the best they can to root their team home, we were talking about money earlier. It's the bottom line is that the league is flourishing. It is, and most play almost every place.
Well, it ain't flourishing around here. And Detroit used to be a good basketball market, and you know, when the Bad Boys teams and the Going to Work teams, their crowds were great, and there's a lot of enthusiasm, even though they didn't have a LeBron James kind of player on that second group of teams. It's dead empty now, Bob. They got a brand new stadium, a brand new place to play, and they are worried about it, the embarrassment of how empty those seats might look when they get going in this new place. And I imagine there are similar problems in other markets. I think it's okay when there are seven great teams. I don't think it's okay when there are three. you know, going in. And if everybody just presumes that it's the Cavs and it's the Warriors and, you know, pick your third. I mean, it depends on maybe you're going to say Houston. Maybe you're going to say Oklahoma City. Yeah. Maybe you're going to say Boston. I don't know. But pick your third. But it's just a third. It's not 7, 8, or 8. And I do think, you know, like, on the one hand, it feels like things are okay because the NBA is always jockeying these games for the big moments, like, you know, if it's a Christmas game or a New Year's game or a big Sunday afternoon game, and they've got the Cavs playing the Warriors or Oklahoma playing, you know, or Houston playing the Cavs. They just keep rotating these same four teams, but it feels like that's all the NBA is. It's just those four or five teams constantly going against one another, featured with the star player against the other team's star player, and all the other markets are also Rands. And I don't study their bottom line, so I don't know if financially this is, you know, if they're all boats are rising because they're making money on the championship ratings. But I could just tell you around here, basketball interest is very, very low, and that's in a basketball town. All right, time for our parting shots. Michael, fire first.
Okay, we touched on this earlier in the podcast, but don't listen to me and don't listen to us about the anthem protests. Listen to Doug Baldwin of the Seahawks, who's been as eloquent and thoughtful as anyone on the subject of these protests. Quote, "This has never been about disrespecting the flag," Baldwin said the other day. "This has always been about trying to better society, and we hope we can work with the NFL to do that. I think it's up to us to speak for those who don't have voices to speak. Working to help those who need help, working to try to make society better, is both patriotic and honorable." You know what's not patriotic and honorable? Jerry Jones trying to make your players symbolically kneel in front of your definition of what patriotism and honor are supposed to mean in this country.
This is how fast an NFL player's career changes. In 2013, when he was 22, Luke Kuechly was the league's defensive player of the year. Thursday night, he left the game with a potential concussion that at age 26 ought to have him thinking about whether he keeps playing football at all. 2 years ago, the Panthers linebacker missed 3 games after suffering a concussion in the season opener. Last year, in a scene many fans remember, he was carted off the field in tears during a primetime game against New Orleans. That marked his second concussion in 2 seasons. Now comes number 3, leaving the game against the Eagles Thursday and not coming back. Kuechly is an exceptional football player, and guys with his kind of drive and tackling skills tend to want to get right back out there the minute the doctor turns his head. But it's his head that Kuechly should be worried about. 3 concussions in 3 years has been enough for other players to consider, or actually do, walk away from the game. It seems unthinkable, perhaps, for the caliber player of Kuechly to be gone by his mid-20s, but what's really unthinkable is what the future could be for such a young man if he continues to absorb brain blows like this. When it comes to concussions, 3 for 3 is not a good statistic.
I saw an informal poll on this subject. 41% of the respondents said they did not give a damn that the USA would not be participating in next year's World Cup. Well, I do. I am disappointed and horrified. Our failure to qualify for the first time since 1986, given all the supposed advances we've made in the world's number one sport pursuit, is a huge blow to the movement, since World Cup interest has driven soccer in this country for the past 27 years. This is disgraceful, losing to Trinidad Tobago when all we needed to qualify was a draw. That's soccer lingo. I know we are not a true soccer culture, but we are a devoted sporting nation, and we have so many great athletes. It's the world's second biggest party, and we can't get an invitation? We should all be embarrassed.
That's going to wrap it up for today. I so want to respond to that, Bob, but I will have to wait till Monday. We enjoyed being with you here, and we will see you on Monday. There's a lot to talk about the NFL weekend, and the NBA season starts next week, so that'll be great. If you enjoy this podcast, please go to wherever you get your podcasts. Apple is always good, iTunes podcast, and subscribe so you get it regularly, and leave a review if you like what you heard, or even if you didn't like what you heard, so we can see how you feel about it. We will see you on Monday. Until then, with Mike Lupica and Bob Ryan, this is Mitch Albom saying have a great weekend.